Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Scroobius Pip, and this week's podcast is fucking amazing. It's really good. It's with a lady called Carla Valentine, and she's a mortician, and we talk about everything basically death-related. A bit of sex in there too, but everything death-related. I should do the advert first. Check out speechdevelopmentrecords.com. It's my label. You can come and support us. You can check out the new B. Dolan album because he's going to be over on tour in September. He's going absolutely everywhere. In fact, while I'm here, I may as well quickly give the B. Dolan tour dates. I'm scrolling through my phone and talking slowly so that I can find those all of them. Yes, so B. Dolan is going to be at the Rainbow in Birmingham on September 15th, the Deaf Institute in Manchester, September 16th, September 17th, he's at the Ferret in Preston, 18th, Electric Circus, Edinburgh, 19th, Stereo Glasgow, 21st, Fleece, Bristol, 22nd, The Globe, Cardiff, 23rd, XOYO in London, 24th, The Haunt in Brighton, 25th, MK 11 in Milton Keynes, and then he's going to Ireland for Cypress Avenue in Cork on the 27th, for the Workman's Club in Dublin on the 29th. I won't do all of them because he's then going to Amsterdam, Lille, Paris, Hamburg, Berlin, Brussels, Athens. Then he's Portland, and he's got more US dates added. He's adding more dates constantly. So you should check him out on tour. It's going to be amazing. And buy Kill the Wolf. The vinyl is finally in stock. You're all so pleased about it. I'm so happy that you've got it and it's all sounding good. But yeah, today's episode is a few people on the John Kennedy episode mentioned how I shut up a lot. And this felt similar. There was so many points where I was just listening, fascinated. I'm in the museum, surrounded by wonderful organs and preserved pieces of bodies. And yeah, it's amazing. So I did keep looking around and getting distracted as well. Another little tip. A lot of you listen on iTunes. I get that. I listen to a lot on iTunes still. But this is one we do. A walkie jumped in on a previous episode about this. We do put this up on Acast as well. And ones like this are particularly good on Acast because we put links to wiki pages, to just further information on the subjects that we're discussing. So while you're listening, you can just listen and you won't notice anything unless you've turned on the ping thing so it blings, but you know, you can turn that off, so you can just listen. But if you wanted to then glance at your phone when something's particularly interesting, then you can save a link or open a link to further information on that, and that's on the Acast app, which you can use on everyone's all phones, all mobile devices. But yeah, that's, you know, that's your choice. I'm not going to hard sell it. I just on ones like this, it reminds me that that's particularly worthwhile. Anyway, I'm going to let us get on with the podcast, and I'll chat to you at the end. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, we're off. Literally, I'm joined today by Carla a Valentine. Is it Valentine or Valentine?
Valentine, yeah, like the saint.
Perfect.
Although I'm far from it.
And how are you today?
I'm really good, actually.
Thank you for having me along. I'll let you kind of say where we are and what we're surrounded by.
Well, we're in Bart's Pathology Museum today, yeah. Which is a purpose-built medical museum from 1879. So it's basically three sort of mezzanine levels full of 5,000 parts of human people.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was saying just before we started, every time I walk around anywhere like this, my brain literally can't compute that these are real. Even though I know, and it's in Bart's, and it's all this, you're looking at things in jars and bones and body parts and all these other things, and it's a film prop. I'm still looking at it, even though it's got details or history. It's like, no, that can't be a real thing, but it's amazing.
It's a bit like something you might see on a sort of Frankenstein film set, yeah, or something, isn't it? Like these jars kind of just, yeah, on shelves. And I think it's because also they don't look very real because they're preserved as,
yeah,
well. So they,
yeah,
lose that kind of fleshy look, you know?
Yeah, completely. Do you find that, or do you get nice and busy? Because the first one that I went to was There's another, is it by King's Cross?
There's one, the Hunterian Museum.
The Hunterian, yeah, that's right. So it's a similar kind of...
It is, yeah, it's similar.
In fact, is there a rivalry? Like, have I dropped one by mentioning them there? Is this going to be trouble? That's good to know.
No, they're quite different, really, because we're part of the medical school, we're part of the university.
Yeah.
So that means that people can't come in here during the day. We tend to have out-of-hours events.
Right, excellent.
Which is why it's so quiet today.
Yeah.
But the Hunterian are open to the public.
I mean, because, again, it's the first time I went in one, I was like, this... And the same stepping in here, this should be one of the biggest tourist attractions in London. I know it shouldn't be a tourist attraction as such, but one of the biggest attractions, because it's fascinating. It is genuinely engaging and fascinating, but also it's educational.
And it's
important kind of thing. So
yeah. I mean, I think that the problem with here at Bart's Pathology Museum is that because it was used by the students for so long, as medical museums like this were for, 100 years or so, they fell out of sort of fashion, when things like virtual reality became a bit more fashionable and whatnot. So as soon as the students stopped using it, it did kind of slide into disrepair, which, for the Hunterian, for example, that didn't happen because it was always for the public. So, yeah, so we've had a bit of a kind of slog over the last 3 years or so just to try and, get it out there. And now we've been on, I think it's CNN's list of the weirdest medical museums in the world.
Amazing.
So, so things like that makes you feel kind of proud, really.
And I mean, I follow you on Instagram, and yesterday you had Bradley Cooper just pop by for a quick look. So
I mean, who would have thought there'd be so many famous people dropping by? When I first got into this job,
it's amazing, though, right?
Because
he's in the Elephant Man, at the moment. So, so how was that? Was he here to just kind of educate himself, I guess, on the character, or to take things in?
Well, what happened is that the sort of sister gallery that we have where Joseph Merrick or the Elephant Man is stored, it's not open to the public, but obviously I have access. Now, he came to visit him a while ago before he started on the West End. I wasn't in that day, typical. He wanted to come and say goodbye, because I think, they've been on the West End now doing the Elephant Man play, and they've got really sort of invested in his story. So they all came along, actually. The whole cast came along to say goodbye. And I think the play finished on Saturday. So.
That's amazing. I love that. And I it always excites me and amazes me when there are these things that are closed off to the public, but important to keep as record. And often it's a preservation thing and in that sense. But also I find a lot of these things often... If there's a good reason that you wish to view this, then people are amicable, are helpful with that and kind of have made that happen. Always, and my brother goes to a lot of art exhibitions, and I'd never heard of it when he was saying, there's a few I've been to where I've had to ask them to get it out of, or ask if I can go and view in storage
because
they have a responsibility to still show these, but they can't have everything on display. So there's
certain
bits he'll say, he'll put
an
email in advance and say, I'd like to... I don't want you to now get tons of emails asking. You can't do that, but that's, again, a unique situation.
Yeah,
but.
I mean, a lot of curators are really, really happy to do that, to kind of take people behind the scenes and show them. I know they do that at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, which is kind of like our counterpart. With human remains, it is really difficult because with the case of Merrick, for example, he's in his own special gallery for research purposes because people are still kind of researching into Proteus syndrome, which is what he had, rather than elephantiasis, which is what people thought he had.
Right.
So there's this distinction made between keeping specimens for medical research and then having them on show.
Yeah.
But then in England, of course, we're kind of bound by the laws of the Human Tissue Authority, which is a kind of governing body for all human remains in different sectors, so the public display or anatomy.
Right, yeah.
So that's why it can be really difficult to get to see some of these things that you think, these are so educational and valuable, but, we're bound, really.
I mean, and I think it's quite a nice thing in many ways as well, because you kind of... Obviously, his story was that at points, a freak show type thing. So in many ways, it's completely appropriate that when he went to rest, that he's not a public... There's a beauty there in itself.
Yeah.
That it's like, right, no, this is important and needs to be respected, but it doesn't need to be...
Gawped
a
at,
load
say.
Of, tourists just going, oh, look at that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a replica of his skeleton, in fact, in the public museum for that very reason. Yeah. And even though, you know, he said that his time with Frederick Treves, who was the doctor who rescued him at Whitechapel Hospital, was the best time of his life.
Yeah.
You know, there is still, is exactly as you say, that aspect of, you know, we still are in touch with his family.
Yeah.
And we still see him as a person. So, yeah, so he's got his own kind of room, you know, safe. And as I say, researchers and people with valid reasons to go and see him and his skeleton, like Bradley Cooper, who was acting as him.
Yeah.
They get to go and see him.
That's great. So I mean, just hearing that small kind of behind the scenes type bit, how much time do you spend just going around and looking at stuff and getting lost in it all? Because surely there's so much that you have access to.
Yeah, I could fall kind of down a research hole if I, you know, want to see. What my job mainly sort of entails here at the moment is to kind of repair and, you know, conserve the specimens at the moment. Mm-hmm. Because some of them are leaky, some of them have gone a bit yellowed. Yeah. So every single time I do a pot, you know, I'll do a good few a day.
Yeah.
I'll end up sort of researching into who is the person in this pot, you know, what happened to them. But then I'll end up kind of researching their condition and then researching, you know, the history of that condition.
Yeah.
And I just kind of fall down a research hole.
To do, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
And again, because they have you've mentioned it, but most of these are incredibly old and incredibly have been preserved for a long, long time. So, yeah, it stands to reason that a lot of them will need
to be topped up
and made sure they're still preserved and in good condition,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. I mean, what's kind of incredible is that, I mean, our oldest one here is 1750.
Wow.
And that is a hernia, and it has a roll of paper in it just to kind of mark out the passage of the hernia, and that's still intact.
Wow.
That would have been preserved in alcohol, and a lot of the specimens from sort of 200 years ago are all in alcohol.
Yeah.
And we, you know, I replace them with a newer fluid, which is a bit more stable. But considering, you know, how old they are, a lot of them are in really good nick, you know.
That's done an amazing job. I mean, we're only 8 minutes in. I feel I need to apologise if at any point I'm going quiet, because I do just keep looking around. There's no response where I am, just looking around at stuff and being stunned. So how did you get into this kind of thing? What was your upbringing? Was there always curiosity with death or with human remains or any of this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those really difficult questions to answer, because I always inevitably get asked it.
Yeah.
But I actually just always wanted to be a mortician. I wanted to be some form of mortician. And I liked the idea of, I did a lot of forensics research. I loved biology.
Yeah.
I read a lot of Agatha Christie. So my main kind of aim was to get into post-mortem work and autopsies. And I did. I was just sort of quite single-minded from the age of about 8 or 9, you know, much to the horror of my mum, probably.
I can imagine, yeah.
You know, we didn't have anyone in the family who was an undertaker or even a doctor. So she always just says, like, I have no idea where you heard it. I probably watched Princey, like that. And it probably stuck with me.
But again, it should be one of the most human curiosities to wonder about, because it's, I mean, we'll go on to it later as well, but when we were discussing this over email, I was saying how I write a lot about death and things like that. And again, all sides of that you've mentioned there, it's stuff that we generally shy away from and kind of go, that's sad, and move on, or be very blunt with this happened and that's that, rather than going into any great detail on it. So it remains one of the great, for most people, unexplored areas. So
absolutely.
I completely understand how from an early age you'd be like, what is
what
that?
Was that?
Why isn't anyone
on?
Talking about? Why isn't anyone explaining this? And again, particularly with children, with deaf, with anything else, you do actively under-explain. You do kind
absolutely,
of say,
yeah.
They've just gone now. It's like,
the dog's just gone to the farm, you know.
Yeah, you really explain carefully how or why I shouldn't go outside or talk to this person or do that, whereas this you're being quite evasive on. So surely that just ignited it more for you
growing
up.
Yeah, I think it did. I think, because especially because, you know, if I did ask any questions, I'm sure my mum would have, you know, had none of the answers whatsoever. And there's nothing more frustrating when you're a kid. Mum, why has this happened? Why has that happened? And they go, oh, it's just because.
Yeah.
You know, and I started to read really, really early. I was actually about 2. So I think I was just kind of getting hold of books. I remember going to the library when I was about 10 or 11 and getting A-level biology textbooks out.
Amazing.
And the librarian just kind of looking at me and saying, shouldn't you be reading Enid Blyton? You know?
Yeah.
And things like that. And then, of course, you know, every child will have some kind of brush with mortality. Whether it's a pet that will die.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was my granddad.
Yeah.
And yeah, I had questions, you know, what happened? Why did he look like that? And nobody would answer them for me. And that was around sort of 8 years of age, 7 years of age.
I mean, I think that's a really important thing and can be a wonderful thing, because children often won't have the, the pre-programmed or the programmings that we have when we get older. So there will be more of a genuine curiosity.
Absolutely.
And not knowing the questions that you're not meant to ask. Because in reality, why aren't you meant to ask them?
Well,
if you're wondering that, it should be that openness to discuss.
Yeah, so. It should be just part of the education. And as you say, you know, children are innocently curious, you know, when they see maggots or something, they're not being morbid, they're just genuinely wondering what's happening. Then you kind of, you know, you grow up and you get called morbid for thinking these things, and actually it's not really the case. So
I couldn't agree more. My mum always used to be distraught when my nan, before any holiday, would tell her where everything is in case she dies. My mum was always like, just go and have a nice holiday. Don't be thinking that you're going to die. And it's like, it'll always be, here's the books, here's the paperwork, here's, if you need this. And it's like, but again, I was always like, that's good, that's fine, that should be.
I mean, there's a
she
huge,
might die.
She's
she
ahead
might
of her time.
You never know. You never know.
It's just practical, isn't it? But also, I mean, she was so ahead of her time, because now there is this huge movement for people saying, you know, you have to talk about death. You have to talk about what you want if you die. Ask your family what you want. Have a death cafe. You know, have death over dinner. There's all these things happening now where people are kind of realizing maybe shoving it under the carpet isn't the best option. You know,
I'm a massive believer in that, in the openness to discuss death and these things. It often confuses people. I'm not sure if I've discussed it on the podcast or not. I've discussed it a fair bit in real life. Not that this isn't real life, but a friend of mine called Jamie Knott took his life when we were all 21, all our group of friends. And the anniversary of his death, which was also his birthday, is my favourite day of the year every year. And
really?
People always see that as a strange thing, but it's because my Facebook timeline fills up with amazing stories about a friend who isn't here anymore. I'll normally meet up with his family or my friends, and we'll sit and just talk about a life rather than be sad on that day because at some point someone died. It's like, well, that's... As we've said, that's going to happen. That's an inevitability. Everyone is going to have that. So the openness to just... to be comfortable with that, I guess.
So it's like a bit of a catalyst, isn't it, for you to sort of have these, in you know, discussions about the positive aspects of him and, you know, that sort of thing.
Completely. So, so how did you then... what was your journey from curiosity as a child to being essentially... in charge of all of this?
Like, the queen of the dead.
That's probably a huge question there. But,
well, you know, it's probably answered kind of fairly simply, to be honest. I mean, I you know, got my head down at school, really, really enjoyed it. Had my you know, I was going to say brief dalliance with, you know, being a bit of a goth at school. Yeah. Evidently not much has changed. but, you know, I did do well in my exams, but I didn't want to go straight into college. I kind of wanted some hands-on experience first because... you know, looking at pictures of dead bodies, watching films, it is not the same as, like, actually, you know, feeling maggots crawl on you.
Completely.
You know?
I mean, and as I said, that you were saying about how a period where so much of this was unused or uninterested, because we then, I'd imagine, got to a point where so much was available to be learnt on computer or in books that you didn't need that.
And it's just, it's not the same. I mean, you know, our curator here used to always say, you don't attempt to sort of take apart a car engine without actually having your hands on, you know, an engine. So, you know, I kind of took a year out, and a lot of my friends went off to Thailand or went to China, and I just went to Worthing and worked for an embalmer for a year. But I did that voluntarily. I happened to know someone. But then
amazing.
I knew, you see, it was cemented in me that, okay, it's not just some sort of passing interest that I've had.
Yeah.
I can actually do this.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing sort of like forensic and biomolecular science. Science at university.
Wow.
And then volunteering at a mortuary again. You know, everyone else was working at a cafe or something or a pub. I was off to the mortuary voluntarily with my lunch, and a job kind of opens up a couple of years into my degree, and they very, very rarely open up. I mean, people say it's a job for life, it's not a dead end job, you know, there's every pun imaginable. So a couple of years into the degree, when the job came up, I took it, because I've always got the opportunity, I always had the opportunity to go back to uni. So then I began to qualify as an APT, which is an anatomical pathology technician.
Right.
So,
amazing.
And yeah, so it went from there, really. That
and
was
I can
my
imagine,
real...
as you said, a job for life, and every other pan. I can imagine how, because of at points the, I guess the tranquility or the seclusion that this, it gradually becomes your collection.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is, you know, which again, that's an amazing thing to have a collection that's hundreds of years old and so vast. So I can completely see how it'd be hard to walk away from at some point to go, all right, well, just pass this on to someone else.
Yeah, no, it's like a little paradise, isn't it, really? I think, I'm sure it was in Evelyn Waugh's The Loved One, and he said, there at the quiet limit of the world, he experienced a tranquil joy. And that's about this, the pet cremating protagonist of the story. And it's kind of like that for me. It's a sort of, it's a quiet limit of the world. And it's the same in mortuaries. I mean, you do obviously have to interact, you know, with your co-workers and families, etc. But when you do post-mortems, you tend to be alone or alone with the pathologist. Mm-hmm. And you do just get used to this sort of quiet, you know, solitude. And then here, of course, I'm the only full-time staff member. So I literally do just kind of come in and have no one to say hello to apart from the 5,000 pots.
Apart from all the parts.
So, yeah, so now that I'm kind of...
Do you find yourself talking to them?
I do, yeah. Particularly the skeletons. And we've got our Skello Biafra over there. He's our sort of museum mascot. He bears a lot of, you know, the complaints.
Yeah, I can imagine. You're an advocate for the access to collections, which contain a human remains. You mentioned earlier that because of the restrictions in the UK that these things are tough. Let's talk about that for a bit. What's the...
So basically at the moment, I mean, in the 90s, there was this, many people will remember this sort of organ retention scandal. And it was when in hospitals like Alderhay, there were sort of some organs found at the back of shelves. There was no such thing as a consent culture back then. So doctors who did autopsies on, you know, babies or young children or whoever would take parts, organs, to do further testing on, but they didn't inform the families. Right. And it caused a bit of an outcry when it was discovered.
Sure.
So in sort of response to that, the Human Tissue Authority was formed in 2004. And the thing about the HTA is everybody thinks it's been around for a long time because it's sort of in its way, it seems very archaic, but it's only very new. It's only sort of 10 years. And so what they... did was they've made it so that you need to have licenses for different activities or scheduled purposes with human remains.
Right.
So with this museum, for example, public display, all of the specimens that are on this floor that are easily accessible, these are all over 100 years old.
Right.
Because they're outside of the HTA's remit. So we call it the historical collection.
Yeah.
It hasn't really caused us any problems because obviously we can have people come in for events and all of these are exempt from the HTA.
Yeah.
But what it means is that with the teaching collection on the upper two floors, we need a display license to show the general public.
Right.
So, for example, all the forensics up there, you know, all the kind of really interesting ones that people want to know about from, you know, court cases and things like that, they're all upstairs. So we do have a display license on its way, winging its way through the mail. So we're kind of doing everything by the book, as it were. But the interesting thing is that we still have people who criticise us for letting the public see these older specimens, despite the fact that we're not doing anything against the law.
No, that's bizarre.
Despite the fact that we're not doing anything bizarre or disrespectful, there are a sort of chunk of people who think that these specimens should only be available to people who are of a medical disposition, that, you know, maybe students, medical students or doctors, and the general public should not see them.
Surely a greater understanding in general, you know, is should be desired there. And as you said, the ones you can't show upstairs, the fact is they're the ones that would ignite more interest in the way that interest was ignited for you as a child, because they're the ones that have a story and have a something that you can relate and learn, rather than a walk around and look at. I said, I guess that's kind of where the issue comes in, but they're the ones that would feel more human.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there'd be that it is a more recent thing and there is a tale and a relatability to it, whereas you can easily walk around here and, as said, just imagine it's because they're from so far in the past, I guess. Imagine
maybe
it's hard to compute that they ever exist.
Yeah,
you're more removed. Exactly.
Yeah. So. And I think, I mean, it's kind of, it's interesting though, because we do have a lot of really unusual conditions down here on the in the historical collection, things that you won't see again, things that are kind of a product of the cult of like Victorian factory culture, for example.
Yeah.
A lot of things like, you know, chimney sweeps, cancer of the testicle, the young boys that went up chimneys,
right.
A lot of injuries from, you know, these awful factory conditions.
Yeah.
And they're really, they've got their own value because they're so great for sort of historical and sociological research.
Yeah, of course.
But as you say, with the forensic collection, I kind of feel that even though some of the specimens are very disturbing,
yeah.
I've seen far more disturbing things in TV and computer games over the last, you know, 10 years. There's been this huge growth
Completely.
Of sort of Gorno films and everything.
Yeah.
And I feel that, you know, I'm not qualified to say that I think I'm right, but I feel that maybe we are creating a much more violent culture because we're so far removed from the reality of violence.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say. I couldn't agree more. I paused because I've never heard the term Gorno and it's wonderful. so that was delightful. I just need to re-highlight that in case anyone didn't take that in. But, but yeah, I mean, it's completely that. It's we see this kind of thing regularly, but this is the cold reality of it. And that's surely, again, it's far more important and educational in that respect. And as you said, to bring it to kind of counter a lot of the fictional stuff, to show that these things are real and this is the real human anatomy. This is the real results of
this is the real
of these things.
Of like, you know, stamping on someone's face or whatever we have. And I think, to actually see that, you know, there's that phrase, seeing is believing. And I think to actually see it in real life would create, you know, a much more important kind of discussion and obviously educate people far more than with some computer game or some TV show and that violence would... That has like a negative impact, but for some reason, as I say, there are people that don't feel that, and they feel that actually, you know, these things are too disturbing. We shouldn't show them to the public, and I think those people are quite far removed from what's going on in popular culture.
Yeah,
you know. So I remember when I was at school, for example, learning about the Nazis when I was about 15.
Yeah,
and just not really taking it in. You know, you're 15 years of age. You're kind of spraying your deodorant on. You're reading a magazine and not really taking it in and understanding what it was about. And then, you know, years later, seeing piles of human hair in a museum and understanding suddenly what had really happened.
Yeah.
And I think that is the value for these specimens. You know, they can be a symbol of violence. They can be a symbol of veneration, you know, in terms of, say, holy relics. And whatever they are significant. And I just think that people should be able to view them, you know, as much as possible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it brings it back to the discussion that we were having, and I'd like to go in more depth on this, on the general, more wide, comfortable and public discussion of death, of death as a thing that happens. How do you feel on that, and how do you feel we could go about making it not seen as morbid? Again, I got the morbid tag a lot because on my first album I had two songs that were about suicide, and there was a song on the next one that was about a domestic violence that eventually caused death and things like that. And again, it was new to me to hear that was anything unusual. For me, I just wrote about something that was interesting. I wrote about something that was interesting and realised, oh, hang on, I've taken something that's interesting in news and put it into pop culture, and I didn't realise that was a confusing thing. It's like definitely something that definitely happens constantly. It seems it was only the injection of it into pop culture that made it unusual or morbid or strange.
It's so strange, isn't it?
You know,
and it's not as if it's anything new. I mean, of course, you know, we've had poetry and art with so much death, pre-Raphaelites, you know, and things like that. And it is odd that there's this kind of this sense of it being morbid when it is just life and it is what happens. So I think at the moment, you know, well, over the last few years, definitely, there is a real kind of death-positive movement. And I know that a girl in the US termed it death-positive because as years before, when we talked about things being out in the open, it used to be sex. Do you remember nobody used to talk about sex?
Yeah, yeah.
So there was this sex-positive movement. And so they've kind of gone with that same template, tried to bring it out into the open. So at the moment, you know, you can do things like go to death cafes where people just discuss aspects of death. There's death over dinner, which is another thing in the US, I think. And for me, I think that when you're talking about death and acceptance of it, there are two different strains as to why it's important. The first thing is a very practical strain. Simple thing is, if we don't talk about death, we don't want to think about it, then when somebody dies close to us, we we're not equipped to make any arrangements. We are able to be taken advantage of by people who are in that industry, like funeral directors. We are afraid of things because we don't know enough about them. So people are afraid of autopsies because
being scared to discuss it, you'll just nod and go with whatever they tell you rather than be comfortable to say, why are we doing that? Or what is the assumption? Why?
And people are kind of getting onto that basically at the moment. I mean, not to say that all funeral directors work in the same way at all. I mean, I'm not saying that, but there are certainly some who are taking advantage of that kind of ignorance and that desire to just want to get it all over and done with. So that on a practical level, that's going to cause issues. And then the other strand is a kind of more of a mental level. Like there's a very, there's a lot of studies that have been done over the last few years that say that thinking about your own kind of mortality can actually really benefit you. It really makes you appreciate your life. And it's nothing new. I mean, the Buddhists have been, carrying out the 9 cemetery contemplations since about the 13th century. They have this Marinasati where they think about decomposing corpses, and then maggots and then dry remains and then how they then go into the earth, and it just makes them accept the cycle of life. So there's nothing new and there's nothing weird about thinking about death. It just seems to be a case of trying to get that message out there at the moment.
And again, I completely think the awareness of it as you said allows you to appreciate your life more, or put everything in that in more perspective, really. Definitely. And to not be, I think, just to not be scared of it, just because of the inevitability. If it was discussed more and it wasn't such a mysterious... Mm. Obviously, it'll always be mysterious because there's different religions, different beliefs, or anything like that. But still, we do know that we're all going to face it at some point. So it's ridiculous to have such a taboo around it.
It is. And I think also what's kind of ridiculous is this sense of moving away from what is natural. It's so much easier for people to accept this idea of like embalming corpses, for example, pumping them full of chemicals that are damaging to the environment. And yet they won't accept being eaten by maggots and, becoming maybe a rose bush or whatever. Yeah. Like the more kind of natural cycle of life seems completely unacceptable.
After I die, I couldn't give a shit. I really couldn't care less. It's such a funny thing that people get so hung up on stuff.
It's my belief,
I don't know anything other than you die and then you die. And that's that. So it's really not a concern. My brother, we're actually out for Mother's Day or my mum's birthday. And my brother kind of bummed out my mum when he was explaining that his ideal situation would be to not have to be dealt with. So his ideal situation would, when he decides he's finished with everything he's been here to do, would be to go up into the mountains or something and not come back.
So that it's
and
just
as simple
sort of
as that.
Done
so it's
over.
Just, it's done, yeah. It's natural, it's in nature, it's part of nature, and not this a weird thing of the family having to deal with this and having to,
go
the death happen
box,
and then have weeks of... exactly, and have all these strange rituals always... Again, I'm making it sound as if there's a lot of death talk in the family, but I always remember when our cat died, and it was emotional because they'd got the cat just after I was born, which kind of made me feel they weren't satisfied, but they were like, let's get something else, this hasn't worked out. So the cat was like 20-odd, it got old, so I'd had it a long time and it died. But I genuinely think the death was made far more dramatic by the fact... A friend of my mum's had made a little coffin for the cat that me and my brother then had to dig a hole for in the garden
and carry out
a little wooden coffin.
Just nice and gothic
and
there.
And it was like, man, this was... It's a sad situation, but that felt like because of the strange rituals at points of our society that it was made 10 times more dramatic and emotional.
It's so hard, isn't it? Rather than maybe just asking what you wanted,
Exactly.
It is hard. And it's funny that, to hear people describe our rituals as strange rituals, because obviously, many people have kind of grown up with them or whatever, and they think of them as normal. Yeah. And trying to change them is difficult. You're obviously going to come across the criticisms, etc. But, you know, it's not that long ago that cremation kind of appeared, you know, from nowhere, and people were going, oh, this is awful, it's inhuman, it'll never catch on. And now it's one of the most popular ways of disposal. So now we talk about things like alkaline hydrolysis, which is basically a type of water blasting. It's like they call it water cremation. Mm. And people say, oh, no, it's disgusting. You can't turn people into sludge, it'll never catch on. Mm. But the likelihood is it probably will within about 20 years or so. People realise that it's not viable to keep doing what we're doing anyway.
Yeah, completely.
That's why these discussions are important, you know. Yeah. I think it was only about last week that a crematorium in the UK has finally sort of set up a system where they can use the heat generated from the crematorium to heat a local swimming pool.
Oh, wow.
And to also heat part of their offices.
Yeah.
But when that was first mentioned, you know, a lot of the British public were like, we don't want to get into a pool heated by the dead. You know,
as if
ghosts are going to kind of be living under
humans
the tide.
Humans are so stupid,
it's
man.
It's very odd.
I can see why you spend a lot of time in here on your own with these ones who just aren't idiots and aren't going to be going on about their
But it's true, you
know,
the more you read about it, the more you do come across these criticisms and you think, just for God's sake. And I wrote an article a while ago about dissection, and, you know, somebody did say something like, well, it was obviously a punishment for a reason. It's because it's bad. And it's like, no, it wasn't because it was bad. It was because there was a huge belief in Judgment Day and God and a fear. And the idea was that if the body was in some, you know, in some way disintegrated, like with cremation, that you wouldn't rise again on Judgment Day. And I thought many people were kind of past that. But, you know, and that's it's a hangover from that.
I mean,
it's
so strange in our society. I'm making a film at the moment, or me and a friend have been working on for a while. And one of the themes in that is looking at suicide, and I do a lot with a charity called Calm, which is battling male suicide and a lot of things like that. But one of the things I've found so fascinating is trying to figure out where our kind of damnation of suicide comes from. Because in reality, the only logical thing that I can think of is, because in reality, a suicide is someone, again, it's different because it depends on the state of mind or whatever, but in reality, that's someone deciding something for themselves. So the only thing that I could come up with was it's a hangover from us being a traditionally a Catholic country and feeling that suicide is a sin against God and you can't get into heaven and things like that. But we're not that anymore. So it's strange that there's that taboo over it. And again, I'm not saying that everyone should just commit suicide. It's fine, it's cool. But there's part of me that feels if you... It's odd to judge someone for choosing their own.
I think it's odd
in their own life to
definitely.
Say you can't do that. It's like, so I have to be a miserable for another. I mean, we're living longer these days. I've got to live for another 40 years. It's like, I don't know. There's something there. And again, that's not to be pro-suicide. But I think I've always said that the only times anything like suicide has ever crossed my mind have been at real high points in life where I thought, man, this is awesome. I could kind of happily check out now and go,
it's not
going
to get better than
I'm
this,
done.
So...
Yeah, I'm done. That's lovely. And again, I don't honestly see anything morally or emotionally wrong with that. If someone was cool, okay. Again, if you have that belief of there's nothing that continues on, it's different because of family and responsibility and everything else. But on that purely individualistic thing to go, I've decided that this is the point... I end.
And it's the same discussion with euthanasia at the moment, actually, isn't it? Voluntary euthanasia,
Of course,
and people, you know, people are being told, no, you can't make that decision. And you're right, it's all a hangover from times past.
It's all such weird decisions, isn't it? Yeah. It's always my argument, and I don't smoke, I don't particularly drink much or any of this, but that's for health reasons now, so I can enjoy myself more. Now I feel physically better. Every time someone says, oh, it'd take years off your life, it's like, yeah, but it's off the end of your life. That's the bit I want it off. I don't
I'm
not
going
to be like, oh man, I need five more years of not really been able to walk much, or, you know, depending on how your life goes.
Because we are extending it, aren't we? Yeah. But the actual quality of a lot of people's lives isn't, you know,
exactly. So I've not got that desire to live forever and live on and on and on or whatever. So any health choices I make now are to improve my enjoyment of life now, not to extend
later on.
My life.
Exactly.
So you mentioned death positive and coming from sex positive. Now, obviously, again, I'm following you on Twitter and Instagram. Mm. You are also a big discusser of the links between sex and death. Yeah. There was a fascinating picture you posted of Dita Von Teese
Victor Noir's grave.
Yeah, in one of the big Paris graveyards.
Pelle Chaise, that one.
Yeah. And so, yeah, what's your fascination there? And what's the kind of, what do you see as the link between sex and death? Because again, they're both, as we said, they're two previously taboo subjects.
Which is one link, kind of. I mean, I suppose the most simplistic way to say it is that one is the beginning of life, usually, one, and one ends it, you know.
Yep, sure.
So you've got this, you know, this kind of scale then from between one and the other one, which sort of links them in a way. And I think like anything, I mean, if I decide I want to find a link between food and death, or, you know, animals and death, you'll find them all over the place.
Yeah, of course.
I'm interested in our interaction and our relationship with human remains, for example. And that might be our relationship with them in this context, or it could be a very intimate relationship. So, for example, in Indonesia, where they actually dig up their deceased every few years and reclothe them.
Oh, wow.
I also read a lot about necrophilia, which, you know, is always great dinner party conversation.
Sure, no doubt.
So because of that and the sort of sex and, you know, sex aspect of that, I kind of look more into different sex and death links. And, you know, again, you can find them if you look for them, but they are everywhere. I mean, there are plenty of animals, for example, who will have sex to death in order to procreate. And then, of course, you have got these, you know, little things like Dita Von Teese on the grave of Pere Lachaise, lots of weird sort of death themed
and because it was seen
stories.
as a fertility thing, wasn't it? Is that the story?
He was kind of a bit of a young man about town in 19th century Paris, I think, and he had his effigy placed on top of his grave, and he's got a very prominent penis.
Yeah.
So of course, somewhere the rumour started.
Fair play to him.
Yeah, I mean, who knows how much he exaggerated?
Why wouldn't you? Yeah.
what did he pay the guy to make it?
Yeah.
But so this fertility idea came about that if you sort of climb on, if you rub it, you know, a bit like Juliet's boob. I think you can rub Juliet's boob as well, can't you, in Italy. So, but of course, with Victor Noir, it's a grave. And, you know, there are other things in cemeteries. For example, there's one in the US that have a cemetery hotties tour.
Right.
So they kind of have looked at who's buried in the graveyard, and the ones that are good looking, they've created a sort of cemetery hotties tour.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean,
I'm finding it equally creepy and fascinating as well.
It's a whole world. But yeah, it's, I think as well, just over the last few years, I mean, one of my fascinations, having always been interested in kind of Gothic literature, Gothic representations of necrophilia and things that tend to actually mean something different. You know, they mean everlasting love, they mean acceptance of death. But then we suddenly had this kind of neo-necrophilia in all these paranormal romances for teenagers.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can get an Edward Cullen vibrator, for example, pink and sparkly, and you can keep it in the fridge.
Again, I mean, with so much, again, a link there that I don't know if there's a natural link that's been made more socially acceptable in the vampire, in the whole vampire trend, because that's obviously the undead or whatever, but Twilight to True Blood and things like that, where
absolutely.
It's incredibly sexually charged. But those two things seem to sit comfortably together.
Yeah, and I think Buffy kind of did it well first. And, you know, I get to read these amazing papers like Necrophilia and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know, which is always fantastic. So they kind
of
did it first.
Is that a paper or fan fiction?
It's a paper. I wrote my own fan fiction. they started it. And actually, when you look at it, I think a lot of it does stem from what we've been talking about. It's from a fear of dying. So when you read Twilight, for example, there is a lot of this sort of Bella projecting her humanness onto Edward. She wants him to kind of save her from her humanness. She keeps talking about how she could die, you know, they could die. It's like a fear of death again. And I think because we're living in this era where we're sort of trying to talk about it, trying to skirt around the issues of it, that's why it's become popular. I mean, zombies, for example, in the sort of medieval Europe, we were intimately, you know, transgressively connected to rotting corpses. We were so intimate with them. Now, the only time we see them is when they're like an object for our terror. I think it all kind of stems from this desire to start talking about mortality.
Anyways, I don't know why we were choosing it. Our first album, me and a guy, Dan Lesac, was going to be called Le Petit Mort, which is
The little deaf, it's a French term for an orgasm. Exactly.
And
yeah.
Again, I don't even know why we had that in our idea as an album name, but I just thought that was again a beautiful thing.
It's kind of iconic. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's why I'm Le Petit Mortician on Twitter.
That hadn't even twigged. Of course, yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Because I'm also little and I am a mortician. But actually, you know, there have been some ECG studies that. On women who have a clitoral orgasm, and when they do so, part of their brain sort of basically conks out. So it's the part that's responsible for kind of language and memory. So they say that actually it's proof that you do have a bit of a little death, when you have an orgasm. And, you know, as I say, with being in a Victorian medical museum, I study a lot of the history of medicine and things like anatomy dissection. Many years ago, there were the anatomical venuses, which were used by the students rather than real cadavers. And they were made of wax. Mm-hmm. And they're beautiful women, gorgeous hair, eyes kind of half closed in ecstasy, but yet their organs all sort of spilling out. And they,
are
a really strange kind of juxtaposition between death and sex.
Yeah.
So yeah, the more you kind of look into it, the more you find.
It's fascinating with how much, as you were saying, how things will feel as if they've been that way forever when they're not. I always remember reading about and again on the discussion of sex or orgasms or whatever else, was that there was a time where doctors would administer orgasms for hysteria, or is what they called hysteria. So when it was felt that, because again, particularly at that point, a woman didn't do anything rude and didn't have sex outside of marriage.
Yeah,
so it was seen that there was a build-up of tension. So again, that was seen as a medical thing, if there's a build-up of tension that needs to be released. And I believe it's where vibrators were originally invented, that it was a medical tool that you'd literally, again, clinical, no romance, would literally be seen as just a physical thing of we will apply this device in the appropriate area to relieve the stress if you imagine that now,
that'd be outrageous, but
you think of it, the reason it'd be outrageous is because of old-fashioned thoughts. It's like, no, it's new. Old-fashioned thoughts,
yeah,
if you know
things
what I mean.
Things definitely go round in circles. And that's, I mean, the thing about the hysteria and the vibrators, we've actually had quite a few researchers in here talking about this, because you can imagine I was fascinated by this, whether or not it was true. Unfortunately, some of them debunk the idea.
Oh, right,
they think that a lot of these adverts that say, you know, electronic massager for women's health is to do with just electricity being, you know, a stimulating thing.
Right, yeah.
But the jury's still kind of out on it, to be honest. But I know that a lot of the electricity stuff came from galvanism, which was when they used to reanimate the dead bodies as well.
Oh, wow.
So
yeah.
That was where Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, you know, came from, this
of
idea
course.
Of galvanism. So again, you've got this link between, you know, sexy sort of electricity, death, stimulation. So the links are definitely there. I mean, I populate my blog with them, so there's plenty of them.
It's fascinating. You also, there's the dating website for morticians.
Yeah.
How did that...
Well, you know...
What's the story behind that?
Yeah, Dead Meat came about because...
Dead Meat, again, dead meat.
The puns just come thick and fast.
But again, I mean, all joking aside, it's an unusual job. And as you said, there's been numerous times you've said, oh, this is an interesting conversation at dinner or whatever. But again, if that's your day-to-day and your life, I can imagine that can be a restrictive thing to me.
Well, yeah, because
here's what I want to talk about, but it's the first date, so maybe I shouldn't mention.
Exactly. This is kind of where it came from, you know, this idea that, I mean, partly it was because I also had the idea as a bit of a joke in my head, and I thought, hang about, I'm Le Petit Mortician, I'm the one who does the blog on sex and death. If I don't create this dating website, then I've missed the trick, you know. I've got to get it done. So I did just think, right, just do it. You know, it was quite a bit of work, because I'm not particularly computer literate, you know, my talents lie elsewhere, human beings. But I just wanted to create a kind of networking. It is dating and networking for death professionals, basically, is the tag. And I wanted it to be a bit like a LinkedIn, as well as a Plenty of Fish or a Uniform Dating.
Because
a couple of my friends now are people who are in the same job I used to be in. And I think it's really valuable to still have those people in my life.
Purely to build, again, I mean, dating aside, purely to build those kind of communities and have that accessible. So you have these kindred spirits and people that you can interact with and not feel how far should I go with this? How much should I say or reveal? Having that comfort, I think that's hugely important. And
definitely.
I think it's one of the ways, I mean, as much as Twitter and social networks in general can, there's a lot of negative sides. I think things like the trans agenda movement and I mean, LGBT in general, yes, things like Twitter can potentially open you up to more abuse, but they definitely 100% make you aware that there's more people like this and more people going through this, and be able to contact people that you can discuss
and have that thing.
And I think that's why it's important to, as silly as it may seem, if you're thinking of it, to build communities like that and say, here's a little network, here's a
Definitely, because you know, if you're a death doula, for example, it's kind of difficult for you to find other death doulas, or, you know, it's a place where people can post events that are happening, and it's, and as you know, as you say, people can have a conversation with each other and know that there are no boundaries. They don't have to kind of dip their toe into the water first.
Know that they're safe.
Yeah,
and it's
exactly.
It's a safe environment in
that way. And it kind of also was inspired by the fact that I obviously know a lot of morticians and APTs, and a lot of them are in couples. You know, before I created Dead Meat, they find each other. Mortuary managers find embalmers. You know, pathologists and nurses will get together for that very same reason.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'd feel I'd be doing an injustice now to not mention that if you do decide on changing the website at all, one of our main sponsors is a website called Squarespace, which allows you to build a website. So they're one of our sponsors because I found them and used them to build my website.
Right,
and it was so easy, because I'm the same, I'm clueless on that kind of thing.
You definitely do without help.
And literally I found that, and it was the easiest, just drag and drop and simple
brilliant.
Stuff. But yeah,
it's hard work.
If you fancy it. I mean, we're at 45 minutes, so I should start trying to wrap things up, but I've no desire to, so let's continue on. Can we talk a little bit about initially embalming and what that entailed, and as that was your introduction, I guess, on the and then into mortuary work in general, and all the different kind of links along that chain you want to share anything
I think
on.
It's something that, again, the general public get a few things mixed up. You know, when I tell them I work in a mortuary, for example, they think that I put the makeup on the deceased, which is, you know, the embalmer's job. So,
that was it. I wasn't sure. All of
so
that is
because
when you said, I started off in embalming, I was like, right, I think I might have been thinking of that.
As
at
my
that point,
actual,
anyway, and then
So embalming is kind of like the end of the chain, basically, when you're at funeral directors already, and it is the process of basically beautifying the corpse. You know, it came about in the sort of 1800s in the US, and it was because soldiers in the Civil War were unable to get back to their families across, you know, the states, so doctors began to preserve the cadavers, and it sort of caught on.
Yeah.
So it involves an injection of fluid which contains a lot of formaldehyde, which is not particularly great for the environment. And then it involves kind of some cosmetic procedures, you know, making sure that there are no orifices open or leaking, you know, which may sound undignified, but it's like when you go to the dentist, they stuff you with cotton wool to stop you spitting. Same thing.
Yeah, makes sense.
Bit of makeup on there as well to make you look realistic, and then you can be viewed by the family. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword, because obviously some families want that. They want their deceased to be to look like they did in life. Other people don't, which I think the important thing is that you make a choice about it.
Yeah.
The reason I obviously went to kind of learn about it is I didn't know enough about the process to have an opinion on it before I went to work in it. And also, I think the main thing is just that it can be that funeral directors will force it on families, and I think that's the main issue. I think if some people want it, then that's, you know, I wouldn't say don't do it. But I think the problem comes when some funeral directors call it hygienic treatment.
Right.
They tell the family, for example, that they have to have a body embalmed, otherwise it's not safe. And that's nonsense.
Yeah.
You can actually catch less from a dead body than you can from people on the tube. So I don't know how often you take public transport,
but
maybe that'll put you off.
Yeah.
So that's the problem with it, really. It's the end of the line. It's kind of it's a cosmetic process, and it should be a choice.
It's fascinating, isn't it, that there's such a... It becomes such a default when it is a cosmetic treatment just before you put someone
in the ground.
And then again, it's sad and not meaning to be insensitive, in the ground where they will remain until they rot.
Yeah, exactly. And they will rot. And this is another thing that embalming was, you know, kind of criticised for many years, is because people were told, families were told, well, they'll be preserved, you know, right. like some kind of uncorruptible holy yeah. saint, which isn't the case. So I think it is important. I mean, if some people feel that they want to see, you know, their relative that way, then I think, you know, that's up to yeah. them. Some people actually want it to happen to themselves. And what is really weird is that there is a new, over the last couple of years, there is a boom in cosmetic surgery for the dead.
Wow.
So, for example, people
end
going,
go
I want
high.
My lips done, yeah. You know, paying the doctor to come and do their lips, make sure they look great on their last day,
that's
you know.
So crazy,
which
isn't
is,
it?
Again, it's if it's a person's preference for themselves, you know, that's one thing. Sometimes it's a family member's preference for their relative because it makes them feel better. It's a lot of different reasons why people do it.
It's bizarre.
But I think what's important is to know about it. I think yeah. everybody should maybe watch a video of it on YouTube, watch the procedure. Do you want that to happen
again,
to your relative?
All of these things, education is... Mm. So rather than as much as I am judging people for being absolute weirdos and wanting to look extra
special
sexy
for
as they go
day.
Into the ground, yeah. like, or even wanting their loved ones to look extra. It's like, it's, I don't know, yeah. peaceful, comfortable, I can understand. But yeah, I don't yeah. know. But even though I am kind of joking on that, it's just more... not judging anyone for wanting that, but giving them the options,
yeah,
educating
don't go blindly
them on them
it.
And going, right, yeah. here's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't go buy a car without doing some research first,
no.
and it's the same with
exactly.
funerals. It's just, you know, if you don't know where you want to be buried or how you want to go, you need to be thinking about it,
yeah.
because, you know, you wouldn't do it with anything else, buy a house without research.
Yeah, yeah.
So then contrasting with that, what I did as an APT, an anatomical pathology technician, is I was kind of the first port of call. So when somebody's found dead at home or if they die in the hospital, yeah. they'll go to the mortuary, and for the most part, people who've died outside, you know, at home, in the street, the gym, wherever, will need a post-mortem.
Right.
So it was my job to do the technical support for the post-mortem. Mm-hmm. So in things like silent witness, you tend to see the pathologist do the Y incision and take all the organs out.
Yep, sure.
In real life, it's actually the APT who does that.
Right.
And then the doctor will look at all the organs separately, look at the
right.
body, you know, work out the cause of death, and then you will be the one who then reconstructs the deceased.
Wow.
So you'll sew the organs back into the
yeah.
body, possibly do viewings with the family members, and then the deceased is passed on to the funeral directors, so mm-hmm. and then that will be where the embalming is.
Yeah.
So it's different. It's much more of a scientific, you know, exploratory process
yeah.
and investigation rather than just trying to make somebody look good
yeah.
for their funeral.
And again, because of how undiscussed it is, that all gets bunched in together.
Yeah, it does.
That
I mean,
all gets bunched in together. As soon as I mentioned to people I was coming to talk about
yeah.
this, they were like, oh, so is that autopsies or is that this?
Is that like 6 feet under?
And again,
or is
I was
it,
like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm going to go and find
does.
Out, I guess. That's what I'm going to go and...
Yeah, no, they are, because they're so distinct. And I think, you know, the other thing that will happen is that I'll get bunched in with people who kind of just, I don't know, just do weird dissections for no reason, or there's like
yeah.
this kind of this Victorian idea that we just kind of slice into people and keep bits of their organs for nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mentioned before the reason it's important to educate is because people still think that we slice across the forehead, for example, to
yeah.
get to the brain, and then leave a big Frankenstein scar,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and we don't do that. It's all as minimally invasive as possible.
Yeah.
When a person's had a post-mortem, you can't tell. It doesn't, you know,
yeah.
we don't just leave them with bits hanging off them.
I'm making that now a request when I die. I want a Frankenstein scar. I want that. I want to
be
going
It'd be awesome,
down
wouldn't it?
Looking like a maniac. That's completely, I'm adding that.
But they're important. You know, autopsies are important. And,
of course.
For example, after Harold Shipman murdered so many old people,
yeah.
The way death registration and the way autopsies were done really changed. It caused
right.
such a spike in the death, you know, I was going to say fixtures then, the death sort of
yeah.
numbers for that year, that we had to kind of look into the way that we were certifying the deceased, because he got away with murder so many times.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have to have autopsies because we have to find out how people died. And what can be a really dodgy area is when, for religious reasons, people don't want to have an autopsy.
I mean, I understand it's tough. It can be tough for families in general. I've known people someone close to them has died, and they've not felt anyone's at fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's someone who was ill
yeah.
anyway. They're like, look, it's
mm-hmm.
just happened. I'd rather just, you know, not comfortable with the idea
yeah.
that now you're going to cut them up as well.
Yeah.
Not only have they died. So I understand
as
that.
If
but again,
another violation or something.
But
another.
Then it's that realisation that it's important to just, for every element of it, to make sure that nothing
has
untoward has happened, or to make sure again that no one is to blame,
yeah,
that there isn't anyone.
How do you know that
to...
somebody in the family didn't poison
yeah.
them, you know? And if it was
yeah.
the thing about it is, The autopsy, I mean, people always say to me, you know, I've obviously done autopsies on people who've jumped in front of trains, people who've hanged themselves, people, you know, in all sorts of different states of decomposition. And people say, well, if you know that he hanged himself, then why did you do an autopsy? But it's actually not just for the cause of death. It's for any underlying medical issue. So what happens is the doctor will record. So, for example, somebody may have hanged themselves because they have HIV. Their family might not know. Those statistics are then collated for the World Health Organization, who then know where to put money into different aspects of like medical treatment, because they know such and such is on the rise.
Yeah.
So it's not just a case of cause of death, it's underlying issues as well.
Yeah,
you know, and it can be important. And the other thing I do feel like, it does feel a bit like an indignity, but when I go for a gynae exam, I feel like that's an indignity, but I don't
but
not
you know
go.
It's a set, yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I wouldn't tell my boyfriend, you know, oh, you've got a lump on your balls, well, don't go, because it's going to be, you
it's
know,
gonna be a bit,
he's going to put his finger up your bum, it'll be a bit awkward. Yeah. I would never encourage somebody to do that, so I would never encourage in death for them to not have an examination either.
And again, it's as we've discussed so many times now, it's the lack of understanding of all these things that makes it seem like an indignity.
Yeah, and if
it
you
shouldn't be an
indignity. It's not an indignity. You know, I think we're actually far more careful than, you know, I've had dentists poking me and pulling me all over the place. You know, I've been in a gynae exam. I've had 12 students leering in me, as it were.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you have to see an autopsy to understand exactly how dignified it is. Mm. And I think then, yeah, you know, people wouldn't be so scared of it, and they wouldn't think, oh, we need to rage against this. And the reason I bring it up is because very recently the High Court actually accepted that those of the Jewish or Muslim faith can now have CT full body scans instead of autopsies, which is something that I've been in research projects on before, and they are great for some causes of death.
Yeah.
They will not pick up all causes of death. And if somebody...
Yeah, of course.
Has been poisoned, your scan will
it's
not find
gonna,
that out.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, that's the issue really, is that I think it's it's the fear of this autopsy procedure that's caused that.
Where do you stand or feel on organ donation in general in this country and at the moment, I guess?
Yeah, I'm an organ donor, I'm a card carrying, as is my other half, and I obviously advocate that a lot. I think the same thing about dissection, cremation. It's this idea that making a body not be whole anymore will cause issues with, you know, heaven and whatnot.
Yeah,
so I think anyone has a problem with organ donation really needs to kind of examine their motivations for that, because you can save about seven or eight lives with one, you know, decent cadaver, healthy cadaver.
Yeah.
And I think actually we should have an opt-out system in this country. I know there've been calls for it. I think
there's been more calls recently, it seems, for opt-out. And again, it's something I'd always been brought up with by my parents before I even really knew what organ donation was that they'd have their blood donor card and their organ donation cards, that
it's just something that you
do. If something happens, then something happens, but we need to be able to know immediately that...
Yeah, whereas my mum hates me talking about this. I've tried to talk to her about it, and she's like, oh, do we have to have this conversation? You know, considering the work I do, she thinks she'd be used to it. But no, I do. I think we should have an opt-out system. I think if people really do want, you know, to kick up such a fuss, then I think they should have to opt out rather than, you know, us lose these valuable organs every day.
I agree. I think it's the... and again, this might be over going into it, but I think there's quite a natural human state of feeling of huge individuality and self-importance. Mm. And I understand that. Like, I've discussed this numerous times now, but if you're walking down the street, it's almost impossible to compute or comprehend that everyone else in that street has as complex a life as and everything else. So I think that then... a lens into this, because you think, I don't want my, if I die, I don't want my this or my that. But the fact is, if you die, you're one of a lot of people.
Yeah.
You're one of millions of people dying that week, that day, whatever, around the world.
Mm.
And the fact is, as sad as it is and as important as it is, I'm not trying to devalue anyone's life, but there's also some young boy who's got a heart condition who is waiting and waiting
for
the appropriate thing.
I was just going to say, even from a selfish point of view, in this solipsistic, you know, world we live in, but he could turn out to be the person who discovers the cure for cancer, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, even if you want to be selfish about it, he might then be able to help
or,
you know...
Or equally, you could have this horrific accident and not die.
Yeah.
And you don't get saved because the other person was you. Exactly. Was going, oh, it's my yeah. it's my heart, though.
I don't fancy sharing.
I don't want to give my eyes. I don't, yeah. It's silly. We are all just a collection of body parts. Mm. And it's sadly the bits that make us individual is the bit that ends at death. That's the bit that ends. The rest of it, it's just how we've happened to have put things together and shaped stuff. So
definitely, and yeah. I think again, you know, it's this idea that if somebody does donate their organs or their eyes or whatever, that it's going to disfigure them somehow. It's this ignorance of the process where people don't quite understand that people who've donated organs look exactly like everybody else after they've died. You know, there's no Frankenstein scar. There will be if you want one. I'll have a word with my colleagues. But yeah, so I think it's education, isn't it? Knowledge is power. That's the main thing.
Yeah, completely. Well, let's talk as well. This was exciting to me to come here, and that when I was about, I'd say 13 or 14, I had a sleepover with some mates, and we put a film on, and it was on late at night, and it was the scariest thing in the world, just because it was about body snatchers. And in reality, I can't even remember the name of it. I don't think it was that scary a film, but we were so scared because of the idea of it. And it wasn't until I was kind of older that realising there's the one kind of scary idea of body snatchers, but then you also realise that a lot of body snatching originally was a medical people when you weren't allowed to experiment or check or test on human remains, that it was actually the medics that were maybe not doing the body snatching themselves, I'm sure in some points they were, but employing people to snatch bodies. So, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that the sort of history of body snatching is kind of fascinating. Yeah. I probably must have seen something as a child as well. You know, the idea of them going out into the dark graveyard with their lamps and their shovels.
Yeah.
But basically, this idea of human dissection as an advancement to science was perfectly acceptable to the ancient Greeks, for example, who were very enlightened.
Yeah.
Then we ended up in there was this sort of Christian world, the Islamic world, and this idea of slicing into a human was seen as taboo. So for about 1,000, maybe 1,400 years, there was no human dissection. And in fact, scientists such as Galen would dissect animals, dogs, apes, and then apply that to us. So he would dissect a dog and then say, yes, humans have, you know, four spleens or whatever, you know, some weird dog anatomy. And so it wasn't until like the 1500s when people started to dissect humans again.
Yeah.
And what happened was at that point we had, you know, the Enlightenment, we had medical schools, more formal education. And we went away from the sort of apothecaries and medicine men to actual surgeons and medical doctors. And the medical schools didn't have enough corpses.
Right.
So in this sort of desperate attempt to educate themselves, the sort of professors of the schools would pay resurrection men or body snatchers. And they were the ones who would go out and they would open graves in the middle of the night. To put it into perspective, you know, you call them kind of greedy, you know, ne'er-do-wells, but they were earning about a year's worth of wages in a week doing body snatching.
Wow.
So you can see why it might appeal to them a bit
more.
Who
wouldn't, yeah.
Because at the time, you see, from sort of, I think it was from about 1752, definitely in the UK, you could only dissect executed murderers. That was all you had. So, you know, in London we had various different gangs who would go out and get fresh corpses for the schools. And then, of course, it all kind of came to a bit of a head with Burke and Hare, because Burke and Hare, they're kind of the famous body snatchers, but they weren't actually body snatchers. They were just murderers. They just kind of cut out the middleman.
Right.
They just decided to provide very fresh bodies. Yeah. Yeah. It was just like, that's just far too much trouble. Because, you know, the body snatchers were clever about what they did. There was no law against it. But there was a law against grave robbing, which was if you rob material items from a grave.
Right.
So what they would do is they'd make sure they stripped the bodies naked and kind of leave jewellery and whatnot. It wasn't illegal. But yeah, Burke and Hare decided it's all just too much faff for us.
Yeah.
Murdered a few people, got caught. And, you know, the surgeon who bought their bodies, Robert Knox, also kind of ended up, you know, being fired because people said, you must have realised
these have known that they were
bodies were fresh.
Yeah.
And just as a bit of an aside, a sex and death aside, Robert Knox receive the body of quite a beautiful prostitute called Mary Patterson, up in Scotland, and he kept her naked body in a barrel of whiskey for about 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh wow!
Because he drew her, and he sort of would have students come in and leer at the body as well.
Damn.
So you know, again, I think he was a bit of an unusual character.
From the sounds of it.
Yeah. So which is why he didn't really question the freshness of all these corpses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So in 1832, finally, the Anatomy Act was passed in the UK anyway, which meant that medical schools could also have unclaimed bodies from workhouses and prisons, unclaimed bodies from the streets. And it was kind of enough then that they didn't, you know...
It reduced the demand.
It reduced the sort of resurrection men have to go off and, I don't know, do something else.
Yeah.
And it sort of stayed that way for a while until, of course, we then ended up with a consent culture where we could actually donate our bodies to science, you know, is something that is still important. We don't have the medical school here on this campus, but over at Mile End we have our dissection room, and that is populated with people who have consented.
Yeah.
So they're still used by medical students. And it's, you know, it's a very important, as gruesome as it is, it's an important aspect of medical history.
Yeah, of course, of course. Well, I mean, I'll start to wrap up really now. I've kind of covered most things on the list. It occurred to me as we were discussing then and going into Burke and Hare and stuff like that. I don't know if you know anything about it, but I was reading briefly recently that one of the, I believe it was one of the victims of Jack the Ripper, they've just authorised their body to be exhumed because they feel they might have more evidence or something like that in that. So
I hadn't heard about that.
It was only something I read briefly on the way here, I think, and stuff like that just blows my mind.
There'd
be anything that you could.
This far along,
you go, all right.
I don't know about
that.
Turns
out, we didn't.
Yeah, we didn't get all the evidence.
That, yeah.
It's weird though because the Black Museum, the crime museum over at Scotland Yard, which I'm very privileged to have actually been in, they're convinced they know who Black the Ripper, who Jack the Ripper is. They're kind of convinced that it was a Polish immigrant, and they just say that nobody really wants to know that because it's better when it's a mystery.
Yes,
you know?
this exciting story.
I've not heard that, although I can
That's
tell you that apparently one of the victims, Catherine Eddowes, her kidney used to be in this museum, I've heard, in sort of folklore. And a curator from many years ago saw the kidney and just thought it looked, it's just a normal kidney, there's no pathology, and threw it out.
Oh, wow.
So that's what I've heard. I've not been able to find any records.
I'd imagine not in a place of science and medic, but are there any rumours of haunting, of any scary tales of walking the aisles?
You know, not that I've heard.
Good. I'm so pleased.
Yeah.
It's not appropriate.
I think the weird thing is if it was going to be anywhere, you'd think it would be here. So I don't know, you know, whether I believe in ghosts, considering how many dead people I've been around in my life and I've never seen one. I don't know whether I'd even believe in them, but I've not heard of anything.
It always makes me laugh. I was out walking with my mum on Sunday. That sounds a very old-fashioned for some reason, but we walked past this lake and it had a bit of information for there, and it's near where I live in Stamford, and apparently a woman years and years ago had fallen in love with like a stable hand and wasn't allowed to be with him, and asked for permission several times and said no, and then she fell pregnant, her family still said no, and then she drowned herself in this particular pond there.
Oh, right.
It was, again, I think there should be more just bits of history around. But then it had to add, and many people say she's seen to walk up and down this street. And it's like, don't ruin it. Now I'm thinking, that's all bullshit.
If
there's some facts or history, if her body was found there and that's the story, then that's you don't need to add.
It.
That's enough.
Yeah,
you don't need to
agree.
Add
I think, you know, my boss, my sort of line manager, pops over here sometimes and he really embellishes the stories of these parts.
Yeah.
And I always say, don't do that because the actual stories of the parts are incredible themselves, you know, the people in the parts. And, you know, you don't need to sort of ruin it then with like fake sightings of grey ladies and whatnot,
exactly.
You know, floating testicles on floor three. They're just fantastic as they are.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you very much for inviting us in. Where can people keep up to date with everything? What are you on Twitter and Instagram and everything else?
Twitter at Chicken the Dead.
Yeah.
And we have at Bart's Pathology as well. And we've got a website, so it's qmul.ac.uk/Bart's Pathology. So
Perfect.
Hopefully if you Google Carla Valentine, you might find some of these sites.
And what kind of things do you have on? Again, I know I'm meant to be ending it, but we were discussing as we came in that you have occasional taxidermy classes and stuff like that, which taxidermy's obviously become far more popular and hipster these days.
Yeah, that's really grown.
Again, a fascinating thing. So what's the deal
have
there?
All sorts. We have so
I've got
many
tons
events.
Of false endings here. Yeah. Sorry, I keep getting more ideas. Go ahead.
We've got a brand new kind of autumn seminar season that begins in September because it's much more atmospheric in the dark here. You
of
can
course.
See by the ceiling.
Yeah.
So we happen to have, you know, we've got lectures about body farms, which is, you know, where you leave the deceased out to rot and then take measurements for forensic reasons.
Right.
We've got special Halloween events about, there's a vampire slaying kit that's in the Royal Armouries, a genuine slaying kit. So we've got
really?
That.
Really? That's amazing.
We've got, the Poisons of Agatha Christie.
Yeah.
We literally just put on as many kind of different events as we can. And we always give a glass of wine.
Perfect.
A glass of wine,
that's perfect.
Sit in the dark.
Have you ever been to the Horniman Museum?
Yeah.
And have you seen the walrus there that is... It's famously one of the worst pieces of taxidermy ever.
Do you know what? I have been there, but I don't remember the walrus.
I used to go there as a kid, and it's only as I've grown up I've found the story of it. And apparently, again, it's very old, but it was stuffed, or whatever the technique would be, by someone. And again, at that point, you didn't see a lot of animals around. You know, you only saw... It was stuffed by someone who'd never seen a walrus.
Yeah.
And they basically kept stuffing it until it was full. So obviously, walruses have got very saggy skin.
Yeah.
This walrus is ginormous.
Oh, is it?
And it's a big... It's basically a big round ball of a walrus.
Oh, gosh. I don't remember seeing that at all.
It's famous at that particular place because it's just... And I love that they've kept it true
to
what it was.
Yeah, as an example of kind of bad taxidermy.
It was just a case that they just kind of... Whoever it was just like... Right?
Just kept
we'll
going.
A bit more in. It's like, no, that's not...
I suppose it's a bit like doing a bulldog's face or something, isn't it? And ending it with cheeks out
exactly,
here.
Exactly that.
Yeah, no, I think with those... I mean, I love those museums, and I did used to go to museums a lot as a young child, but if it's... I'm normally more interested when it's human. It's just one of those things,
no,
you
completely,
know?
I get that. It's fascinating. Well, thank you very much, and
I will
end this time. So thanks for chatting.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There you go. How was that? That was fascinating. I wanted to keep going for ages. I love all the body snatchers tales and the Burke and Hare stuff. Absolutely fascinating. And again, I would urge you to share this because, as we discussed many, many times in this podcast, these are things that people should discuss more. It shouldn't be taboo subjects. I mean, we talked about the two biggest taboos, sex and death, like constantly for an hour and 15 minutes. You know, it's fine. No one died. Thanks for tuning in, guys. We're going to be back next week, as ever, with more wonderful guests. I'd like it if you subscribed, even though at the start I was telling you to listen to this on Acast. Go and subscribe on iTunes. Get it on iTunes and Acast. What the hell? It helps us in the charts. I should also mention, I forgot to mention this at the start. I did the Doug Loves Movies podcast. I keep forgetting to mention it. If you're waiting for other podcasts, other distraction pieces in the gap, I recommend getting that because it's possibly the most fun I've ever had in 90 minutes. It was amazing fun. It's an amazing podcast as well. I've become addicted to it. It's a Doug Benson, and he has different guests, and they chat about films for a bit, but then they do his different games and quizzes he's made up that are film-based, and it's the most fun. The audience are so into it. They have to come with these names. I'm not gonna hard sell, but it was great fun. I was on there with Roisin Conaty and Richard Sandlin, who does my film night with me at the Prince Charles Cinema, which you should also come to that. I think this comes out just before it, in fact. We've got this Thursday, we've got Leon. Come and see Leon with me. That'd be great. I've got my club night at the end of the month as well. You've probably all turned off by now. Let's face it, on the outros of most podcasts, you kind of tend to drift off around the time they're saying goodbye. And I said goodbye, and then had loads of stuff I was meant to mention. So if you're listening now, good on you. Thanks. But come to the club night. That's at the book club on the 29th. And come to the film club. That's at the Prince Charles Cinema. Head to their website. We've got... This month we've got Leon, next month we've got Trainspotting, so come on down. I'll see you next week. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.